meeting is now being recorded.
Thank you. Hi, Aubrey. Welcome. We're just starting. So with that done, can I ask if there is anybody that's in attendance on the audio bridge but not showing up in the Adobe room, if they would please identify themselves now? I don't hear anyone, so we'll press on.
Yes, David, this is Kavu, so I can't be connected to the network. He said that this system is under the maintenance. I don't know whether it's correct or not.
Okay. Thank you, Caboose. I actually see your name at the bottom of the list of participants, but I take your point that you're on the audio only. Thank you. And could I ask now if anybody has a change or amendment to their statement of interest? Could they mention it now? And don't see any hands, haven't heard anything, so we'll press on to agenda item number two. Last week we discussed this and we confirmed, I believe, that we have reached language for the issue that we're going to seek for public comment on the time for filing issue. So I think we've done that. We've reached agreement on the body of the language. And so now I just want to get into a brief discussion about, you know, how we do this. What is the administrative process of getting something out to public comment? How long will the public comment last? What can we expect? And I think it's in all of our interest to get it out soon. So, Bernie, could I ask you to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. We have to put a wrapper around this text, which is the standard wrapper to announce the public consultation. And then there's the document, which we've agreed to in this fora for the consultation, and we get that out. It'll probably take me a couple of days to get the wrapper around it. It's not any new material. It's just the standard stuff we put around it for the public consultation. There's a few elements that we run through with the rapporteur and ICANN Legal just to make sure that we're meeting all the requirements for public consultation. Then we send it to the public consultation team. They look at it, make sure everything's okay, one final check, and then they post it. Standard public consultation period is for 42 days or 6 weeks. After that, we have a month or two, depending on what we're looking for, to analyze the comments and produce a report on the public consultation. I'll be glad to take any questions if there are.
Thanks, Bernie. I don't see any hands. I have a question, one or two small questions. I take it from what you said that in order to get it out, we're talking probably a week or two or so, but at least that it would be released prior to ICANN 62 is my guess. And if I'm correct in that, then I might ask you if I could get just, you know, 2 or 3 minutes at the CCWG plenary to announce to the assembled group that this is fact is out for public comment. I know it'll be announced on the list, but we might as well try and mention this as widely as we can, and since IRP sort of emanated from that group, it would be nice to mention it to them. So do you think, am I correct in that assumption, Bernie, it'll probably be out before ICANN 62?
We're going to try our darndest, but when you get right up to against the meeting, sometimes things take a little longer to post, but we will be working on trying to make sure that we get that up as soon as possible. It should be possible to get it up before ICANN 62, and I'm certain the co-chairs would be glad to give you 5 minutes on the Workstream 2 agenda in the face-to-face meeting at ICANN 62, or right the day before ICANN 62, actually, so you can chat about this.
Okay, good. Yeah, I want to disseminate it widely. So thank you. Does anybody have any comment, any concern, question about this? We're going to move forward with getting this issue out to public comment. One of the implicit assumptions behind that is we're going to be able to sort of work out the differences on the remaining issues, and I personally think that's possible and probable. But if anybody has a comment, please weigh in now or during this call. I don't see any hands, so we can probably move on to agenda item number 3. And I'm just trying to get my laptop sorted here. Bear with me 1 second.
David?
Yes, go ahead, Bernie.
I believe from last week the group was expecting a confirmation of a second reading of this request to go to public comment so we can be well within the rules. Maybe you can just ask if there are any objections.
Exactly. Thank you. That's a good point. So are there any objections to considering this discussion a second reading on the issue on the plan to submit to public comment the time for filing rule discussion using the language that you've seen on the list? Does anybody have any objection or any concern about that? I don't see any hands and don't hear anything, so I think we can consider that done. Thank you, Bernie. The next issue is one, I'm sorry that Malcolm is not on the call, but it's one about types of hearing. And I'd just like to go through this briefly. I'll do my best to give an objective statement as to what Malcolm was saying about this, but I actually think we're quite close on this and we can close this down. But the two sort of competing documents, and they're largely in agreement, but I'll call them competing for the purposes of this call, are Rule 5 and the updated supplementary procedures that we agreed and sent out for public comment, you know, over a year ago. And Rule 5 is what we all agreed to when it went out as part of the body of the updated supplementary procedures that went out for public comment. And as I mentioned on the list this morning, I've taken a look at Rule 5, and here's the way I would sort of mention the principles that underlie Rule 5. And they are things that state that an IRP should be conducted in such a way that it will be expeditious. It would reasonably have a low it would have a reasonably low cost. It would ensure fundamental fairness. It would ensure due process consistent with purposes of the IRP. The panel would have to consider notions of accessibility, fairness, and efficiency, and that efficiency would be both as respect to time and cost in conducting an IRP. IRPs would be conducted by electronic means to the extent feasible, but where necessary, live telephonic or video conferences could be held. Rule 5 made a presumption that in-person hearings would not be permitted, and that presumption could only be rebutted if all three conditions were met of the following three. An in-person hearing was needed for fair resolution of the case. An in-person hearing was needed to further the purposes of the IRP, and considerations of fairness and furtherance of these purposes outweigh time and cost, financial expense. Any such in-person hearing would not be for introducing new argument or evidence that could have been presented otherwise. Hearings are limited to argument only, except unless a request for witness testimony demonstrates all three of the conditions I just mentioned. Malcolm, on January 3rd, put out, he was largely in agreement, and I think he said that on the phone, but he had some small differences. He had some differences. And he put out a straw man, and I've sort of cited to it on the list a couple of times. But in his straw man, he talks about cost minimization, but that looks pretty much the same as Rule 5, at least in my reading. I'm putting my own interpretation on top of that. His straw man emphasized the use of electronic means to the greatest extent feasible, I think was the language that he used. He had a presumption for resolving things on paper and argument only without witness statements or testimony. That's actually more rigorous than Rule 5 because we do provide for witness statements. In Rule 5, near the end, it says all evidence, including witness statements, must be submitted in so many days before the hearing. So we obviously anticipate written statements. So Malcolm's language is a little bit more stringent than ours in that respect. When it gets to proceedings in person, Malcolm's language in his straw man said that, the IRP panel would have the power to conduct hearings on argument and hearings of witness testimony in person. And he gave 8 conditions limiting it pretty stringently. And he said these hearings could be including by video conference. Later in his document, he said these hearings shall be conducted by video conference. And that potential ambiguity was resolved later where he said only in exceptional circumstances may the IRP panel order an in-person hearing to be held with the participants physically traveling to the same geographic location. Before ordering that kind of a hearing in Malcolm Strawman, he said the panel must satisfy itself that the purposes of the IRP and a fair and just outcome cannot be achieved without that order, and no available electronic means would suffice for this purpose. Now, the reason I'm sort of sorry that Malcolm's not here to discuss this, and let me see if he's arrived, is that my argument would be, I'm speaking as a participant, obviously, now, my argument would be that I just can't envision any case, any such exceptional circumstances, and so I think I continue to believe that Rule 5 adequately and fairly covers what we're addressing here. And I recall Liz's comment last week that there have been hearings where the hearing has reached cost levels of $1 million and $2 million. And so the idea of physically traveling to the same geographic location is really causing me pause. My concern or my argument as a participant is that this should be something where we state principles. I think Rule 5 does that, as I summarized just a moment ago, where we give the panel the ability to sort of fill in the gaps on these principles, knowing what the principles are, including cost minimization. And I would argue, as a participant, that we have to recognize that no one's going to be shut out of a remedy here. Everybody can go to court if they feel that they've been treated unfairly. This is to be an arbitration system that is reasonably low cost, efficient, and so that's where I stand. So I guess I'll have to come on the list and sort of state that as a participant, but I would welcome any other views right now. And I thank Malcolm for a straw man, by the way, but I think that his straw man is extraordinarily close to what we have already, and that's why I feel some confidence that we can work this out. But I'd sort of like to invite comments or questions, concerns, if anybody has any. If not, then I will state, I guess, on list what I just stated now, making that argument, and we'll see what Malcolm's reply is. But I would like to move this on if we can and get moving. Anybody? I see a hand from Greg. Go ahead, Greg.
Thanks, Greg Chapman, for the record. Thank you, David, for going over all of that. I guess what I'm – and it is unfortunate that Malcolm is not – here, because what I'm trying to get to understand is kind of on a more conceptual level what Malcolm is trying to accomplish and where he diverges from what we had before. Because on a drafting level, it seems that, you know, it's made some things more complicated and less likely, and other things maybe slightly more likely. Maybe one major difference is that the panel has the power rather than the participants to call for an in-person hearing or a video hearing, which I think is worthwhile, you know, allowing the panel to have that discretion as well as the parties, if that's where there's a difference. You know, all the conditionality, you know, I feel that without kind of a strong understanding of why this works better than Rule 5 or is fairer or contains costs better without affecting results, that we're kind of better off with Rule 5. You know, if there are any particular tweaks that come from Malcolm's straw man that could help Rule 5, that's also, you know, a possibility if it's not a binary choice, which it might be at this point in time. And I guess, you know, one last thing, you know, since this is, well, it is an arbitration, I think that when you say anybody who wants to can go sue, you know, there'll be a question about whether you exhausted in administrative remedies. I'm not sure whether this would be a required administrative remedy to exhaust, but certainly the court would, you know, look at you sideways if you said, you know, we didn't do the IRP, but just came to sue because we thought it was, you know, useless, too expensive, why not just go to court, et cetera, et cetera. The idea is to try to keep these things out of court. And, you know, I think that while we may have had very expensive hearings in the past, you know, these are complex matters. And whether we can, without looking at the hearings that have taken place in the past, can't know for sure how valuable or useful it was and whether it was just a, you know, waste of time and money. But I'm going to assume, unless I know otherwise, that there were good reasons to have these expensive hearings and that it was a better way to achieve what needed to be achieved than, you know, doing it on the papers. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. I would note that under Rule 5, the IRP panel is supposed to use electronic means to the extent feasible, but they can order live telephonic or video conferences where necessary, and they can allow for hearings if those three conditions that I mentioned are overcome. So Rule 5 gives some latitude on having a hearing. Where Malcolm's straw man differs, though, is his explicitly allows an in-person hearing to be held with the participants physically traveling to the same geographic location rather than by e-means. Now, he has a preference for electronic means rather than this in his straw man, but this would be allowed if the two circumstances were met that I mentioned before. One, that a fair and just outcome could not be achieved without such a hearing, and that there's no available electronic means. And where I would come on the list and sort of take that up with Malcolm is, I can't envision those conditions ever being met. It's too fine a point. We should let the panel handle this under the strictures that we have in Section 5. But I take your point, and I take it that you're largely in agreement that Rule 5 is probably the way to go. I take your point on admin remedies have to be exhausted. I guess I was thinking more along the lines that someone has a remedy if they're ever timed out, but I shouldn't necessarily make that point in this case. Does anybody else, Greg, is that a new hand that you have?
A follow-up, David.
Go ahead.
Under Rule 5, is there the option ultimately of an in-person hearing? I just don't have it right in front of me.
I have it here, and I don't see that. I don't believe, when you say in-person, I take it you mean traveling to the same geographic location.
I mean flesh and blood.
In the same room.
Yes.
I don't see that.
Yeah,
I don't see that in Rule 5.
Yeah. I would add that. I think that is an option that should be considered. I think that the problem with Malcolm's statements is they're stated too high. You know, there has to be some sort of reason, you know, something below could not possibly. I mean, it's even beyond a reasonable doubt. If the standard is a standard of certainty about something in the future, you know, there's not even a reasonably in that the first of the two standards that you read. So the way they're drafted, they basically you would have to have some situation where you would have to positively and absolutely demonstrate that anything other than, you know, hearing was impossible it goes too far. You know, if we dialed it back a bit, made it still, you know, a high bar, because it should be a high bar, but a bar that still has, you know, some realistic possibility of being met under exceptional circumstances, then that would make more sense. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Samantha has her hand up, so it's over to you, Sam.
Hi, I was typing into the chat as well. My reading is, and I think, and someone correct me if I'm wrong, but Rule 5 states that there is the ability to rebut the presumption against in-person hearing. So even though there's a presumption against it, there's the ability to rebut that presumption and to move forward with an in-person hearing, which is what I heard Greg said would be important to have, so that there could be the potential to call everyone to one place. So does that go to your concern, Greg, or did you have a different concern?
It does go to my concern, thanks.
Okay.
It's David speaking again. I guess I read it differently. Sam, you're correct. Let me read the operative language as I see it from Rule 5, the one that we drafted and went out to public comment. It says, the IRP panel should conduct its proceedings with the presumption that in-person hearings shall not be permitted. The presumption against in-person hearings may be rebutted only under extraordinary circumstances where, upon motion by a party, the IRP panel determines that the party seeking an in-person hearing has demonstrated that, one, an in-person hearing is necessary for a fair resolution of the claim, two, an in-person hearing is necessary to further the purposes of the IRP, and three, considerations of fairness and furtherance of the purposes of the IRP outweigh the time and financial expense of an in-person hearing. In no circumstances shall in-person hearings be permitted for the purpose of introducing new arguments or evidence that could have been previously presented but were not previously presented to the panel. Pardon me. So that's the language. I think that's acceptable, too. I think it allows for flexibility, and we ought to go with that. But because Malcolm has an interest in this, I think I'll come out to the list and say, Malcolm, and it'll be to the list. You know, we discussed this. I think there's everybody's satisfied with Rule 5, and I think that's a fair statement. When I say everybody, I mean everybody that was on this call. To answer Aubrey's question in the chat, Aubrey asked, what exactly is different in Malcolm's change? I lost it. Malcolm is actually a little bit more stringent in one respect, but he actually gets into the Rule 5 does not talk about physical meetings. Malcolm's rule does, and he says physical, I'm paraphrasing here, physical meetings or hearings could be held only in exceptional circumstances where the IRP panel has determined that purposes of the IRP and a fair and just outcome is impossible without such an in-person physical hearing, and that there's no electronic means that could satisfy having a fair hearing. So I think that's where we are. I need to come to the list, but I think that we can press on with the assumption that this is not something we're going to need public comment on. Aubrey, your hand is up. Please, you take the floor.
Yeah. Thanks for re-explaining it to me. So really, he's not asking for anything different, just far more stringent conditioning. And because the other was kind of implicit already in as it exists, if it's a presumption that it's not except in exceptions, then to say it isn't except in exceptions are really fairly similar. Not quite sure I understand why he wants it that much more stringent, but I understand the favorability to 5. Thanks.
Thank you, Aubrey. And let me again stress that I'm trying to read his straw man objectively. You know, it wasn't something I drafted, and so I hope I'm being fair to Malcolm. But Malcolm also went into much more detail on when an IRP panel would have the power to conduct hearings. And he had, you know, he listed 8 conditions, and a number of them have subpoints. And so he is much more detailed. His straw man was much more detailed. I believe it largely agrees with Section 5 or Rule 5, and I believe Malcolm has even said as much. But this was important to him. It did address some differences that he thought were important. And so for me to come out on the list is going to take me a day or probably not until Monday. And so in the meantime, I would encourage those in the call to read his straw man. You know, maybe you'll pick up something in it that I haven't. But I believe that we're both very close. And my position is I'm stating it as a participant, which is really Rule 5 is sufficient, and Malcolm's position is stated in his straw man. So I would encourage people to look at it. I'm trying to describe it, but it's not the same as reading it. Thanks, Aubrey. And so we'll proceed forward on the assumption that this is going to be worked out. I believe it will be. And we can move on to the next next agenda item, and that is to review the interim rules. I've asked Sam or Liz if they could sort of lead this part of the discussion and step us through the interim rules. And so I have some comments along the way, but I guess I should probably just give up the floor and not necessarily try to tee this up and ask Sam or Liz if you would kindly take us through the interim rules.
Sure, David. Bernie, can you flash up the document that we sent in May? And I don't recall, I haven't scrubbed the list for it, but I don't recall if I've seen too many responses back or areas that you'd like me to focus on. So I'll first throw out the question to those on the call today. Is there anything from what you reviewed in this document, if you have reviewed the document, that you'd like me to focus on first? And David,
Sam,
I see your hand up.
Yes, and I put it up because I'm going to do this as a participant, and I apologize for not being more specific. The things I'd most be interested in you talking about are joinder, translations, and I've seen the traffic on the list. On the interim rule, and on the interim rule for time for filing, I've seen some mail back and forth between you and Malcolm, and I think that you've answered his questions, and I think it's in good shape. But so I would ask you to deal with those three first, you know, the time for filing in light of your emails with Malcolm, and then joinder and translation. Thank you.
Sure. So on time for filing, for those of you who were on last week's call, you might remember David posed a question about there's a concern about some fairness to those who might be caught in deadlines if we had a repose period as is proposed within the interim rules while we await the outcomes of the public comment for determining what will actually be put into the final rule. And so I identified last week that I thought that ICANN could be in a position to agree that we could have some transitionary clauses in the final set of rules that would give some time for those who had a 120-day period run during the time that the interim rules were in place, but were actually time-barred because the action happened more than a year before under the interim rules. And so I have confirmed that internally, and so I sent a note out to the IOT last night, LA time, to identify that we agree that we can do something like that so that we're not actually prejudicing anyone in the event that we wind up with a longer period than 1 year for an outside repose in the final set of rules. Malcolm came back with a question about, so what does that mean? How long would they have to file? I think that that's one of those time periods where maybe the IOT would want to think about it. I think in my response to him, I said, you know, I don't think it would make sense to be any longer than the 120 days after the new rules go into, or the new supplementary procedures are in place, but we could identify within the IOT what we consider to be that reasonable time frame after the new rules are in place for that that quote-unquote old claim to be brought. So I think that's a detail that we can talk about further, but we were trying to address that concern that and also to demonstrate our commitment that we're really not trying to use the interim rule process as a way to prejudice anyone in how they would participate in IRP later. So I don't know if there are any other questions on this list about it or if the email traffic on that has answered your question.
Thanks, Sam. David speaking as participant. Yeah. I think it did answer the question. I do think that you bring up a good question. We ought to come up with a time limit that someone would have to file in. To me, 120 days probably sounds like a natural, but not more than that. But that's something we can discuss. I don't think that needs to hold us up right now. I shouldn't say that. I should say that's my feeling on it. If anybody else would like to state a suggestion in that respect, please do. But I believe what you've done, And what you've said, Sam, is that no one would be prejudiced by us going out to public comment. I tend to disagree with Malcolm in his response to Liz, where he said we've never agreed to the 12-month. Actually, that's the rule that we sent out. We did agree in our first iteration. And so I don't have any problem with going out to with an interim rule that says 120 days on one hand, 1 year on the other, with the carve-out that you described that nobody's going to be prejudiced while we're seeking public comment. So I'm happy with that. That's my feeling on it. Thank you.
All right.
And let me ask if anybody else has a comment. If not, Sam, we could move to joinder and translation unless you have something else you want to say about that.
I think that that's all I have on that one. So I'm going to scroll down to find translation. So let me deal with translation first. So we have here, so I'm just trying to figure out where this is. If anyone has it off the top of their head on the page number, let me know because we're going to have everyone scroll to that. All right, so I think we're on page 6.
Okay, and also let me just mention to folks this was in your email of Thursday, May 31st.
Yes, thank you. So under Rule 5, we've previously agreed among the IoT that we needed to make sure that there was some reference to translation of proceedings. There is actually a reference to translation in the ICANN bylaws. And so we know that this has to be, or we think it makes sense to have it included in the procedures as well. So as we were looking over the conversation from within the IoT to consider if there was text ready enough to go into an interim set of rules, we identified, and you can see on the footnote that we include in here, on footnote 20, that we have, so we initially said that it might need to be incorporated into a public comment or something, but there was also some question as to the scope of what translation services mean. I'd like to point the IoT members to that May 31st email, because in there we identified some more specifics about why we thought this rule was not ready to go into the interim procedures and where we thought we might need to focus some effort on drafting and some decision-making among the IoT in order to get to the final rules. And so I raised some of the concerns such as translation of pleadings or people's briefings actually can be considered part of a legal strategy. It's really important for people to believe that the translation is an adequate representation of what they've put forward. And so I think we need to consider if we think that all translations are part of administrative costs or if there are certain parts of translations that are considered legal costs, would we think that translation is always ICANN's responsibility to obtain? Or if it's of a legal pleading, would that be the responsibility of the submitting party to obtain and part of their legal cost? And if you recall, within the cost structure of the IRP, ICANN is responsible for all administrative costs, and for the exception of the community IRPs, each party is responsible for their legal costs. And so this does have some actual impact in terms of the cost of the proceedings to both ICANN and the claimant, depending on where that is cut. And so we laid out some items in there, in that email, to think about. The proposal that I made within that email was that I think we can go one of two ways. We can either get some of these thoughts over to external counsel now to start a drafting exercise to see if they have some proposals of how these items can be worked into a final set of rules. Or on the IoT, we could carve out some time in one of our meetings that will happen soon to see if we had a sense of where the IoT wanted to go on this. I think we could go either way. For the for the timing concern, because we do have some budgetary concerns around external counsel and when we can access them, I think I'd lean more towards getting this issue to external counsel to have them weigh in on the text earlier and to pose some questions back to the IOT if we're not able to get this issue teed up for fuller conversation within the IOT sooner. But I think that also weighs towards, if we're looking at getting out a set of interim rules, that I'd also ask for the IOT's confirmation that this isn't yet an issue that's ready for inclusion in the interim rules, but we will have it ready, likely without need for public comment. I really don't think we need it in order to get into the final set of procedures. David?
Thanks, Sam. Dave McCauley speaking as a participant. Thank you for the comments in the email that you sent May 31st. In my opinion, I think you raise a good point about costs, about legal strategy, and whether part of this may be in costs. Let me just, before I go on to my conclusion on that, just address one or two other things in your mail. With respect to the appendices, translation of appendices, we don't have page limits. The one thing that we did say is in what we were going to send to Sidley is we said that when considering the translation of documents, the panel or emergency panelist should endeavor to strike a fair balance between the materiality of the document versus the cost delay to translate. And it seems to me that materiality would be, you know, maybe lesser than appendices, depends on the nature of it. So it may be covered, and we might want to see what Sidley sends back in response to that request. And the other thing you mentioned in your mail was mention should be made of the proficiency of the claimant's representative in English. And I think what we said in our suggestion to Sidley, in addition, if the claimant includes more than one person, for instance, claimant is a corporation, then if a responsible member of such persons, e.g., for instance, an officer of the company, speaks English, that would suffice for using English. As you know, that's the example we use to Sidley. So that's, I think some of this is covered, but I take option number one, I believe, as you stated. We should pose these as questions to Sidley. We should do whatever we can to get this to them. We are almost out of time on getting anything from Sidley. And so I don't think we can tee it up any further. What I would suggest is that I can't read footnote 20 right now, but basically that we send what we had in our suggested instruction to Sidley, along with your questions, asking Sidley to pose some considerations and alternatives for us. Does anybody else have any comments along the lines? Or Sam, do you have anything you want to say in response?
Thanks, David. I agree with your suggestion. I think let's get it over. I agree that the what you're talking about, the balance around the different types of information and the costs and stuff that could go to the appendices, I think that we might want to be a little bit clearer about that, but I think it's still I had the same sense of it, but I thought it still left a little bit there might be more that we could do on that. But I think that you and I, sounds like we're on the same page.
Thanks. I think we're on the same page, but Sam, I need to ask you and Liz for some help here. And what I'm speaking about is in getting something to Sidley, I would sort of ask, I think we're going down the road of using your red line document. And so we had two choices. We could have given the instructions the way we were going, but that did leave a lot of uncertainty. And as an alternative, you proposed the red line version. So I'm going to need you to make sure that you have the red line version in such fashion that we can send it to Sidley, you know, both, you know, maybe the clean copy of it. But what you should send to the list, I think, is the final red line version and clean copy showing what we've discussed. And I think Malcolm would probably agree with what you said on time for filing. I think you probably answered his question satisfactorily. And showing the joinder and translation with some translation questions. You know, boil your email of May 31st down to the questions that we would pose to Sidley. that we then in this group can take a look at and say, yes, this is what we need to send, or no, it's not. Let's tweak a little bit here so that we can get that done. We have to get it out. Today is June 7th. If we did that, if we finalized that next week, June 14th, we'd give Sidley half a month. Let me also state parenthetically, Bernie, you and I should make, could I ask you to make an action item that you and I should get ready to call Holly and tell her, unfortunately, it's coming very late, but it will be coming. And we need to figure out a way to make sure it happens in this fiscal year. I think, Sam, you said we have to make sure we get a bill in this fiscal year. I don't know how it works, but
no.
We need to.
No.
I'm sorry.
We don't need a bill in this fiscal year. We need to have them, we need to actually have them do their work within this month. We get the bill
okay.
A little bit after the end of the fiscal year, but they need to do the work within the fiscal year. And also,
okay.
David, I know that you and I had an earlier exchange with Holly when we gave her a heads up, so we can also just write onto that chain and say, hey, this is going to start to come.
Okay.
So what I take from your point, David, is an action item of we would send them the interim rules, not really as a direction of what they're doing, but to show them what we're thinking on the interim rules, and it's a document that they can work from, and it shows some of the places that we've progressed. And then they might have some ideas on some of the language that maybe we've inserted in there and how we can, you know, better it for a final set of rules. And then we also have at least this translation issue, and I think the joinder issue as well, which Liz will talk to in a minute, which are places where we've identified some concrete questions that we think would help guide the final drafting of it, which also supports why we're not ready for it to be in this interim set. On the time for filing, I think we need to await the outcomes of the public comment before we get too much other language or use their time too much on it, because we don't want to, just because there's money available doesn't mean we should have them bill to do things that are still under community conversation.
Thanks, Sam. That's a fair point on time for filing. I misspoke. I actually think the language we have right now is going to be good anyway. I don't think we really need Sidley's help on that one. But let me say yes, and we'll get to Liz in just a minute because we have 15 minutes left. But does anybody in the group have a comment, question, concern with what the discussion has been over the last several minutes? If not, let's press on then. Liz, if you're done with this and we can move to Liz, Sam, I'm sorry, if we're done with this and we can move to Liz, then we ought to do it.
Works for me.
Okay, Liz, you have the floor then.
Okay, thank you, David. This is Liz Lay from ICANN.org for the record. I think with respect to joiner, as Sam indicated, we think that there is still some work that needs development. So it's not yet ready to be included as part of the set of the interim rules that goes to Sidley. But, let me go over it. I think the language that we have in the draft interim rules that Sam circulated is pretty much the language that, based upon our various discussions, we seem to have agreed upon. I don't recall there being any oppositions or discussions to the contrary on the current language. I think it seems that additional work is needed from the group, but not the kind of material change that would require us going out for public comment, but there are certain concerns that I think have been raised by ICANN and others in the group, such as if you had somebody who is joining as a party, how is party defined in that instance? For meaning, is that intervener then defined in the same way as a claimant? And they have the same status as a claimant in the IRP. I think we've also raised certain questions about needing to work out the procedures related to briefings and schedulings and filing fees and any other practical issues that may affect the efficiency and progress of the IRP. For example, in instances where the intervener joins at a stage when the IRP has significantly progressed along. It should there be some kind of limitation on the right of a party to intervene? I think other things we've raised and discussed as a group that we still need to work out is for intervention as a right. Is there some tethering we need to develop to the dispute so that not everyone and anyone can join and intervene as a right, but there should be like some kind of nexus requirement. So I think these are some of the things that we know needs to be further vetted by the group before it's ready for inclusion into the final set of rules.
Thanks, Liz. But let me ask you this. The things that you were just mentioning sound reasonable to me, you know, timing, et cetera. I'm trying to, like, in the red line that Sam sent around, are those addressed in the red line? Maybe I missed it. I don't know.
They're addressed, David, in the note. She's annotated it in the note mm-hmm. that there are certain issues that we need to flush out still.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to page 8.
No, I see it. I see it now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a few issues. We do not have a definition of party here, so we need to that if we mean a claimant. Okay, how do you propose that we proceed on this?
I think this is something, a conversation that we can seek comments and from the group on list, or if we can discuss it in the next couple meetings. But I think if it's something where you would like us to propose something that can be a starting point for discussion.
Well, thank you. I'll tell you where I'm coming from when I ask such a question, and that is we have to get something to Sidley now. And so my sense of this is on questions like you posed, for instance, we don't have a definition of party here. So we would have to decide what do we mean by a party, that someone comes into this, they've joined in having the quality of a party. What do we mean by that? Are they a claimant? And if they're a claimant, are they somehow making some kind of a request for a judgment that something did or did not violate the bylaws, or do they have some other standing? Those things I imagine we'll agree on. What I would like to know before next week is what impact does this have on us getting something out to Sidley? And the reason I ask is we don't really have a couple of weeks to sort through the nuances of this and get something silly. I take it that we're going to have to work on this in the background separately. And so are you proposing that we send the language that you do have in Section 7 to Sidley right now with the understanding that we will then be working on the questions posed in the note? Is that what the request is?
Yes.
Does anybody
I think that's a fair approach to go forward.
Okay, so then I'm going to ask in a minute if anybody has any comments, concerns, or questions. I see Sam's hand is up. I'll come to you in just a second, Sam. But if anyone else has something to say about this, please do. I will be looking, Liz, to you and Sam to sort of tee this up then. But go ahead, Sam. You have the floor.
Thanks, David. I think when we send them this information, we should also accompany it with a note of these are the other things that the IoT is still looking at or the things that we're discussing. So that way we can kind of flag for them what the other work is. They can provide some inputs if they have additional thoughts on those or some guidance. And so I think we should read them in on what the other things we're still considering are when it's sent over.
Thanks, Sam. And can I look to you and Liz to sort of tee this up? I mean, to tee up this whole document with the idea of some questions on translations and on joinder.
Yep, and we'll look through and see if there are any other things that we highlighted as necessary for some further conversation.
Okay, thanks. I think it would be a good idea if we can, Bernie, I might ask you to help in this respect, is if we could find, you know, a 15-minute slot where maybe Bernie and Sam and I could talk to Holly, not about the substantive work that we're doing, or, but just on with respect to heads up, you know, we're going to be asking questions we needed to get done by the end of June, that kind of discussion. Sam, if you think we can handle it in email, then that's fine. But I just want to, I guess we have to get this part of it moving. So, again, I'll invite others on the call to comment or have state any question they might have. If there are none, I thought I saw a hand. If there are none, I'll ask, Liz, are you done with what you wanted to say on joinder?
Yes, David, I am.
I think we can move to Section 5, Agenda Item 5, further thoughts on our work after the rules, unless somebody has something else that they would like to comment on the discussion so far. I don't see any hands. So you'll note that I sent an email to the list about work that we have once we get the rules sort of tended to. And what I mean by tended to is sometime soon we're going to have one rule out for public comment, our work on one rule out for public comment, time for filing. And we will have a document in front of Sidley asking them for feedback on the interim rules that we're working on, and we'll be working on questions in the background. We'll have those three things going, but it's quite possible that those three things will be wrapped up, let's say, by mid-July. When I say wrapped up, we won't yet have had public comment back, understanding that. But we may soon come to a point where we can turn our attention elsewhere, which would be a welcome day. And so that's why I put that list out there. I know Shireen was interested in what else we might have on our plate. And so please be aware of it. We'll probably want to turn our attention to the cooperative engagement process first. And we may at some point, maybe next week or maybe in the call after next week, but we may at some point want to discuss, you know, the constitution of the IoT team itself. You know, how do we feel? We're a small group. We've become much more effective recently. Do we want to consider how we move forward? I'll just state it generally like that, and sort of as a follow-on to what we discussed last week. But that's really what the purpose of that was, to sort of put my thoughts on paper as to what we yet have to do. I don't think I missed anything, but I might have. So if you see anything while you go through the rules, I'd encourage you to flag it. Any questions or comments before we go to any other business? So let's go to any other business. I'll state one thing. I'll reiterate what I was asking. This may be especially helpful at ICANN 62 for those who are going to attend, is please, again, be mindful to help your various advisory committees and supporting organizations on their work to establish a standing panel. It's important work, and I know there's a lot going on with GDPR and everything else, but please help your organization as best you can. Anybody else have anything they want to state on any other business? If not, I'll go to work in the next day or so on a mail about types of hearings, and we'll look for something from Sam and Liz on the interim rules. And, Bernie, I might ask you to sort of remind us that we need to get in touch with Holly, and we'll figure out how to do that. Again, that's not going to be a substantive discussion. It's going to be, dear Holly, here's some work coming your way. Sorry it's late, and sorry it has to be done in the next few weeks, but that's the way it is. Before we wrap up, does anybody want to make any statements, have any comments, questions? And I'll look up to the top. Nope. If not, then that's the end of this call. I want to thank everybody for being here, and see you next week. And there'll be some mail in the interim. Goodbye, everybody. Thanks very much. We can stop the recording.